Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
I think people might actually go and see this film, hoping that it's going to be good. This is the first ever like PSA I've had to give to the audience because I don't want people to be fooled. Do not go and see this film.
What?
It is really, really bad. It
no
is
way.
2 hours and 45 minutes long.
Whoa.
And it is terribly written. The dialogue is atrocious.
This is good, because you don't have to put this in, but if you don't want to, but this is good because I preheated the mug with
I
water.
Saw.
Yeah, and
I
it
saw.
Works. And now it's piping hot.
It's winter, you have to.
Yeah, yeah, and I can only get like a few sips in at a time, which is fine.
Yeah. In my, I noticed this trailer trend when I went to the cinema yesterday to see a film, and I saw the Wonka trailer for like what must be the 10th time now. Mm. But I noticed they had the, from the studios that brought you Paddington. Mm. And Harry Potter. And I'm like, should I be excited that the studio that brought it? Where does it end?
I think it's just more...
commissioned in the same office as...
Yeah, breathe the same air as...
Yeah. It's like, Brad Pitt isn't in this movie, but he might watch it.
Yeah,
like,
also, what? Commissioned by the same studio that made Harry Potter 20 years ago.
Yeah, ages ago.
I think it's
like
more
this,
that you're sitting
that.
In the cinema, you're not really paying attention, and then you see the title,
in the Harry Potter text,
and Paddington.
Little, yeah.
And people go, oh, I love
yeah,
those
I love
movies.
It, yeah.
So you have an emotional feeling.
Yeah.
Your brain releases a nice little emotional thing, and then your brain will connect that with the images they see in the trailer.
But where does it end? Is it like, Marlon Brando is dead, but would probably like this movie?
It is a stretch. What I'm finding a bit more irritating is, I mean, it's just so transparent and cynical, is where like, so obviously they're advertising Wonka on, you know, Instagram and TikTok, and they're like, yeah. Warner Brothers is like, we're in our Wonka era, and I'm like, oh, it's so cringe.
It's the worst.
Trying to use TikTok slang to market your movie. There's nothing more.
It's giving Chocolate Factory vibes.
Yeah, I know. This guy woke up and chose chocolate. You know, yeah. I'm like, just stop.
Just stop.
We know you're a brand. Stop trying to talk like.
I actually am kind of looking forward to it. I think we've given
Wonka
a bit
I'm
of pre hate, but we're just
no,
sort
no,
of
no,
we're
open.
In for it.
I'm
yeah.
open. Like I said, Paddington director. Yeah. Chalamet, Christmas in Charming.
It's from the studio of those who brought you Paddington and Harry Potter.
Do you know what it's giving, actually? If it is giving anything, to use that phrase, it's giving Mary Poppins Returns.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
It could be
but
like...
Do you think it'll be mostly enjoyed and then forgotten?
It could be.
Which yeah. Mary Poppins Returns,
although
I
think
has
been. Yeah, it has been forgotten.
It's not become a cult Christmas classic.
Charming at the time, and then yeah. It might get forgotten. Wonka will probably spawn sequels, though.
Sure, yeah, I agree.
I'm going to say at least two.
It's like at Christmas, no one is going to go, let's watch the sequel to Mary Poppins. People yeah. are going to watch Mary Poppins.
Yeah. Yes.
That year it came out, people will go, let's yeah. watch Mary Poppins Returns.
Yeah.
But not for the rest of the time, I don't think.
Although, yeah, I think it's the kind of thing that at the Christmas season is probably put on BBC One at about four.
Oh, that's the thing. If it's already on, you might go, oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Did
well, it literally happened last year. I went, oh, my God, yeah, I went to the cinema to see this.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was all right. Anyway,
yeah.
What else is on?
Yeah. Meryl Streep also in that. Could have worked for the co-star countdown last week for Emily Blunt. No, 2 weeks ago for Emily Blunt. Meryl Streep is in a scene in Mary Poppins Returns. She's like the kooky witch lady.
That's right.
Yeah.
The topsy-turvy house.
Yeah,
that's
yeah.
absolutely...
Yeah. That totally
wow,
just came
I
back to
about
me.
That.
Sorry,
yes.
I was calling back to a co-star countdown game from 2 weeks
that
ago,
been
which
a,
Emily Blunt was the cast member.
That would have been a good cast this countdown in a way. Ben Whishaw
yes.
and other people. Emily Blunt.
Lin-Manuel Miranda.
Meryl Streep would have thrown me, actually. That's quite a good one.
Yeah. Lin-Manuel Miranda's really got his like brand of just being rolled out for the sing-songy, cozy film.
Sing-song with a modern twist.
Yeah.
With a hip-hop vibe.
Yeah.
Don't you worry
with a beat.
Yeah. Yeah, we're the streets of London and we're chimney sweeps. We're going to rock
this
all
is
around
the cool
to the
song.
Streets of
yeah. For the teenager that didn't want to see the movie, but now there's something for
the
them.
For the teenager that didn't want to see the movie.
Brought to you by that song from Lin-Manuel Miranda. Yeah, it's like Lin-Manuel Miranda looked at this script and said, I like it.
Yes. Five stars from Lin.
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 Lynn.
Lynn.
Lynn, you've got to stop making funny little songs about
maybe
things,
Maybe it's Lynn. Like L-Y-N-N, like he's Welsh. Lynn.
Yeah,
Lynn Manuel
thought,
Miranda.
Thought, yeah. Like,
Glynn. No, it's Lynn.
Yeah. Glynn.
Glynn Manuel like Miranda. Six L's in there.
Glynn Manuel Miranda.
We're going to see that new one with Glynn Manuel Miranda.
Very sorry for that one. I don't know where that went. I don't know. Wimmer Miranda. I don't know where you went there. To a country
Jamaica.
That doesn't exist, basically, yeah. Welcome to episode 103. This is for...
We're steaming on.
Absolutely steaming on for Pop Kitchen. 103. Any 103...
There's no 103s. No. 102 Dalmatians was a stretch last week.
Yeah, 103rd. 103rd.
Precinct.
There's lots of precincts. 103rd. Hey.
103rd, yeah, I was part of the 103rd.
The 103?
Yeah. My father was 103.
That's so funny. My father fought with the 103.
Yeah. I led you into battle. I was 109.
He lost his legs, and then I found out somebody came back with his legs.
All that army speak, I never understand it, but the characters do. Yes, it was the trooper precinct 11. I'm always like, yeah,
well. Precinct's police.
Whatever.
But you mean like, well, no, I know. Okay, hang on.
Yeah, I think you know.
Okay, so when I was like, so... I watched Band of Brothers when I was very young, loved it. And then I read the book. And I remember at the beginning of the book, it says something like 12 men to a squad.
Oh, nice. That's good.
Three squads to a platoon.
Oh, see, this is what...
Three platoons to a battalion. Like four battalions to a regiment. And then like three regiments to a company. And then like... five companies to a division.
I just see like the zooming out of an army. Yeah.
And Band of Brothers, of course, was about easy company. No, I think companies before regiment, but either way, that was about easy company, which was part of the 101st Airborne Division.
That's
right?
That's great.
No, that's it.
Yeah, that was great. That was giving real like Boomer Dad World War II obsessive energy. But
I
loved it.
Anarchy Day.
Let me go get you some of my files.
Where are you going?
We've got an entire 4-hour documentary on this exact subject.
Yes, that's every Ken Burns.
Did you see they've released a trailer for a new one?
Masters
of the Air.
I've seen
the same with Austin Butler and
Yes, but from again, a Tom Hanks, Steven Spielberg thing. I haven't seen the trailer, but I know about it because Tom Hanks basically came off of filming Elvis and said to Austin Butler, he was like, you need a new role immediately. Otherwise, you're going to like sink into the abyss with Elvis. It's going to like drag you down. You need to sink your teeth into something completely different. How about this thing I'm making? Go,
yeah.
Would you like this role? Go and do that. Yeah. I love Band of Brothers. I still think it's amazing. I'd love to rewatch it.
I should rewatch it.
It's fantastic.
Seen it once
The Pacific, I watched two episodes of and thought,
I think I finished The Pacific, but I don't remember it as much as I do Band of Brothers.
It just doesn't have the same. It wasn't as good.
Yeah.
The fact is, it wasn't as good. Anyway, this is the 103rd episode of Pop Kitchen today. Talking about two big films.
Mm-hmm.
We're talking about The Hunger Games. Can I get this right, James? A Ballad of What and What?
Songbirds and Snakes.
Right, okay.
Yeah.
And Napoleon.
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 That is as French as the entire film ever
sounded. Yes, and of course, there is also a bonus this week. I am reviewing the Nicolas Cage pseudo sci-fi black comedy Dream Scenario, which has been out a little bit, but... I'm reviewing that in the bonus. If you've seen that, want to hear about it, head to that. And in that bonus episode, I will also give my thoughts on Anatomy of a Fool, which we reviewed as a bonus during our 100th episode.
Yes.
It was a huge film at the moment, won the Palme d'Or at the Cannes Film Festival. So if you want to hear us talk about that, then head to the bonus later this week. But for now, we will continue with The Hunger Games and Napoleon.
We're going in. I feel like... last week, we brought the heat with terms of reviews.
We're really sorry.
And I really don't want to be that podcast, but George.
Oh, no.
Hunger Games, Ballad of whatever. You know, so just out the gate, there are films that I've reviewed that are bad and maybe worse than this, but I feel like we didn't know they were bad. And I almost feel like a lot of people had made up their mind if they were going to see them or not. For example, The Marvels last week. I feel like a lot of people knew going in it probably wasn't going to be good. Mm-hmm. And they made a decision. I'm not interested. I'm not going to see it. I actually kind of thought... And I think a lot of people, because some people have emailed in and saying, like, oh yeah, like Hunger Games, give it a go. Like, you know, there's good source material there. The book's really good. I think people might actually go and see this film, hoping that it's going to be good. This is the first ever, like, PSA I've had to give to the audience because I don't want people to be fooled. Do not go and see this film.
What?
It is really, really bad. It is 2 hours and 45 minutes long.
Whoa.
And it is terribly written. The dialogue is atrocious. And it's the first time I'm like, I know it's too late because this will come out after the opening weekend, but like, just do not bother.
You're actually saying don't go see it.
George, it was so, so bad. Within 10 minutes, me and Talia were real. First of all, like Saturday night screening, fairly busy crowd, and the film never got the audience engaged.
Locked in,
and within 10 minutes, I was like, oh my God, this is a bad movie. This is a bad movie. Me and Talia realizing we were, like, a lot of the audience were laughing at the dialogue. I'm going to begin. Sorry.
Can I just say,
now my PSA's done.
When you say, like, I had the exact same thing with Five Nights at Freddy's, where 10 minutes in, you go, oh no.
Oh no.
This is a bad one.
Yeah.
This is, like, bad things are happening.
It can take you 10 minutes. Yeah. Especially, and I just going in, I was kind of like, yes, I watched Hunger Games 1 within the last year, and I do value that story, and I think it had, at the time when the Hunger Games was out, did have a big cultural impact. There are a lot of scenes in that I think are really a real mainstay of pop culture, like the scene when everyone like volunteers as tribute in inverted commas, and the reaping and all of it.
Catching fire, great as well.
Totally. And I think, you know, it did run out of steam, and the I don't think the material ever really got to graduate from the Hunger Games and sustain itself, right? And then you get this prequel now that's come out many years after the second Mockingjay film. This is set, it starts originally like, in the opening scene is the rebellion before the sort of new structure of Panem is created. And then we pick up with a young Coriolanus Snow, who is the president in the first Hunger Games films, at the 10th annual Hunger Games. I thought it was the first, but actually it's the 10th.
Okay, so they've already done 10.
They've already done 10, and sort of, you know, the capital is kind of being rebuilt in a sense. There's cranes, they're sort of like, you know, implementing this new structure of the society. I still don't really understand. And again, I've not read a page of the books, which is my fault. But from having seen most of the films, I still don't really understand like the structure of all of the districts and why it works this way. I see the inequality and I understand the dynamic of wealth, and like the further you go out, it's like it's harder and you're more poor. But I don't really understand like the bare bones of how this whole revolution works. Anyway, we pick up with a young Coriolanus Snow, who lives with his sister and his grandma, and he has been basically put in this elite group of young adults who are basically going to be given a tribute who's been volunteered for the Hunger Games. And their job is to essentially sponsor them, nurture them, and essentially coach them to winning. And whoever gets to win is going to basically be graduated through this like elite phase run by Viola Davis and Peter Dinklage to get them into this like higher echelon of society. And it's given lots of success. And they're basically like these young people with lots of power and influence, very much like Oxbridge, you know, graduation vibes. But this is where you'd work into. And the plot goes from there. Carolina Slow is given, is allocated a character called Lucy Gray, played by Rachel Ziegler in District 12.
We know someone called Lucy Gray.
Yeah, Lucy Gray. Yeah, we do know someone called Lucy Gray. And okay, so
sorry.
That's all right. I was like trying to get it in my head. That's basically the plot, and it goes on to do the Hunger Games, and it goes on to have an entire third act. Okay, where do I begin? Dialogue is really, really bad. Sirens on our end. Laughable dialogue. Rachel Ziegler, who I've actually realised I've not seen in anything, but I know she was very good in West Side Story. She's completely out of place in this film. She plays a character in District 12 with a southern accent who talks like this. I'm a Southern Belle and I like to play my guitar, and boy, do I love to sing.
Oh, wow.
And she's dressed in a Disney princess dress.
Yes.
And it feels completely out of place in The Hunger Games. Her dialogue is so bad. I've never disliked a protagonist in a studio film so quickly than I have Rachel Ziegler's character in The Hunger Games.
So is that on her performance, or is that the construction around her that she's been dropped into?
A mixture. I don't think her performance is particularly well-placed within this world, and I also don't think the design elements and the decisions for that character work in The Hunger Games. So during the reaping, she is selected, and it's the most cringeworthy thing of, like, you've got this really iconic reaping thing where people are selected through, and it's just so overly dramatic where she collapses to the floor and looks to the camera and goes, "You can't take my..." And it, like, goes into a song.
A song?
And I'm just stop singing. It's horrible. It felt like I was being sung at. It was so bad. I never believed the relationship dynamic between Coriolanus Snow and this. They have this like, we need to like be together to get through this, and there's this like slightly sexual dynamic, but not really. Is it false?
Sorry, isn't that also a bit like the first Hunger Games, where it's like we need to pretend to be in a relationship to sort of...
There's loads of similar characters No, you're completely right. So Peter Dinklage, who I actually think is really good in this, I love him in everything, he plays basically the same character that Woody Harrelson plays in the first one, a jaded alcoholic who's trying to use alcohol to mourn the memories of their previous interactions with the Hunger Games, who's very much within the system, but is very cynical and trying to use his political position to like ultimately kill the Hunger Games. You've got Viola Davis, who, bless her, I know is good, but is doing nothing interesting in this film. I think the whole idea they gone, if we have nothing to say, let's make every character look and sound really kooky, and it'll imply a level of depth that just isn't there.
Wow.
You've also got Jason Schwartzman, who's playing the exact same character that Stanley Tucci played in the 75th Hunger Games.
So literally, is the same character.
So they've gone...
You're not joking.
No.
I thought that. He looks like a younger version, right?
No. This is set 70 years before that. It literally can't be. So Stanley Tucci was this eccentric Graham Norton, like, oh my God, the pizzazz and this, and look at District 2, look at that dress. And I kind of got it. It's like, that really works for that. And they've gone, right, we need to have another like media-fronted presenter to do the same job. And it's just essentially... the same character. I'm like, is that all? You've just done the same thing.
But it's not the same character.
Talia thought that was Stanley Tucci and was confused.
That's not
Stanley Tucci. That's Jason Schwartzman. This is set 60 years before the events of the 74th Hunger Games. So therefore, it cannot be that same character. But he's doing the exact same thing. A little bit funny. He does some like magic tricks where he flips a coin and it disappears. It's the same thing. Oh, wow. Also, the function of the Hunger Games being like way less built up and less budget is it takes place in this almost like big concrete cathedral atrium. And it's really boring. It's just a big room. And it gets blown up like before the Hunger Games because rebels blow it up for some reason. And that adds a bunch of concrete and like rubble, and the only reason they did that is so that some people can hide for seemingly ages during the Hunger Games. In terms of to progress the plot. But otherwise, it's a really boring, uninteresting space to do a battle royale.
Match.
Yeah, but more boring than that. Wow. But they're always like hiding under the rubble, and there's always one person who's like hiding up on the thing who gets like, you know, killed in a really boring way eventually. I've never wanted to see a main character get brutally murdered in a film so much. She was... I no disrespect to Rachel Ziegler. A lot of it goes down to like studio decisions and directions, but she was so, so poorly judged in this film.
The violence when people get killed, I assume it's a bit like the actual Hunger Games, where it's very tame and kind of close.
It was very tame. It's shot in a really wide angle lens, all of the action, which is kind of interesting. But unfortunately, when you reveal so much of your action going on in the foreground, background, and midground, it reveals the fakeness of the brutality of actual stage fighting. And it felt a lot like when you used to see Captain Jack Sparrow fighting and he was sort of like ducking and weaving and like a pitchfork goes, whoa, and he's like, whoa. it didn't work for me. Structurally, after the Hunger Games ends, so by the way, I got to 45 minutes of the film. I really thought I was an hour and a half in I didn't, and I had 2 hours left. The Hunger Games finishes halfway through this movie. You then have an entire other third act that is just...
Is that the Ballads of the Songbirds and the Snakes? Is that the bit?
No, it follows on from the story. And I'm just like, what are we doing here? Where are we going? Why is this dynamic happening? What am I still doing in this cinema? What am I doing with this story? I don't like Coriolanus Snow. He's a really like not friendly, not redeemable. I don't want him to win. He's ultimately a bad guy who I know goes on to be like a very bad man. So if there is something like redeemable about him now, I'm not exactly going to hold on for it. I don't like Rachel Ziegler. I don't believe in their dynamic. I don't like his friend. And then you've given me a whole extra hour after the Hunger Games, which wasn't very compelling. And I'm just like, why am I still doing this film? People were laughing at the dialogue. I am repeating myself. People were laughing in the cinema. Me and Talia were cackling. Wow. I said to Talia, they've put a pick me girl in the Hunger Games universe.
Huh.
And it was so, so bad and such a waste of time. I've not been very articulate about this, but I cannot stress enough how disappointed I was with it. I really was... And I wish I'd seen the fourth Hunger Games film now so I could confirm that this is the worst Hunger Games film.
Wow.
But I haven't seen the fourth one, which I know is really bad.
I mean, fair enough. We wanted to go see it because although we were on the fence, as you said, if I had gone to see it, I would have been like you, open-minded, ready to... see this franchise reborn. We had, when we mentioned that this film was coming out at the beginning of the year, someone commented and said the book, because I think Susan Collins wrote, this is based off another book.
Yeah. Sure, which it gives, sorry, like hashed over to a screenwriter energy.
Right. Okay.
But it's actually written by
someone. So apparently the book that this is based on was very good, not just the whole series, but this individual book. And, you know, someone quite rightly commented on our last week's episode and said, we review lots of semi-shitty Marvel stuff.
Yeah.
Can you go and review The Hunger Games for us girlies? You know what? You're absolutely right. And it is that you wanted to like it. It is just
I really thought it would go, yeah, it's like maybe not as good as Hunger Games 1 or 2, but it's better than, it's like a decent film, enjoyable.
I feel a bit sorry for Rachel Zegler because I feel like even before this film came out, for some reason the internet just decided they didn't like
her. I know, she made a couple of like comments about Snow White, which was already getting hate because it was...
It's just seen as like
a couple of reasons to do with like Trail of Dwarves in like other things on the internet where people aren't liking her, which is just different. But yeah, I cannot say that this film did her any favors.
This characters
cringing. I was cringing for her, for her co-stars, for the people involved. I'm like, I really cannot understand how a film that poor is allowed to be 2 hours and 45 minutes.
Wow.
There must be some deluded people who think, yeah, we're telling a really important story that needs this much time. It also has this thing which I found really depressing because I could tell it was done in post, was the film opens with a black screen, part one, the something, and I completely forgot about it. And then an hour later it goes, part two, and I'm like, oh my God, how many parts are there? And then the Hunger Games finishes and it's part three, and I go, fucking hell, this is so clearly done to chapter it after the fact because they realize they can't link these three very separate parts of the film, and they're trying to communicate to the audience that no, it's actually a really intentional pacing decision.
Oh,
it just really, really irritated me, and I was so bored out of my life.
So this is interesting. So that's 2 hour 40 movie.
Yeah.
2 hour 45. Yeah. Napoleon is 2 hour 40. And Anatomy of a Fall, which I mentioned before, we'll talk about the bonus, is also 2 hours. No, that's 2 hours 40.
Yeah.
And I feel like you've got three very different films there. So if you have seen The Hunger Games, let me get this right, The Ballad of Songbirds and Snakes, just rolls off the tongue.
How are we going to put that in our title?
Oh, yeah, there's a thumbnail for this episode.
It's really annoying. We're going to have to be
The Ballads of SNS.
The Ballads of SNS, literally.
If you've seen it and disagree with James, or just let us know your thoughts, please email them into hello@popkitchenpodcast.com. Be interesting to get other people's take on this returning franchise.
Cringe-inducing.
But that is James's very scabrous review.
And just please, if you haven't seen it and someone in your friendship group, which is like will happen, will be like, oh, why don't we see the new Hunger Games? Please just say
no.
No, it's really long and it's really boring. And like, just don't pay money. Don't waste your time.
Because
I think people will be like, if someone says, do you want to see the Marvels? You go, nah, it doesn't look good. People might be, I was hoodwinked by my girlfriend. We were going to see Saltburn. And then Talia last minute goes, why don't we see the new Hunger Games? And I go, yeah, fine, whatever.
Saltburn review coming next week, by the way. Okay. That was The Hunger Games 5.
Such a waste of my time.
I'm ready. I feel so analog sometimes next to you.
Yeah. My thoughts are in the cloud.
Yeah.
So, George, we went to go and see Napoleon this week.
We did.
We went to a lovely screening in Leicester Square. The IMAX.
IMAX screen.
Same place we saw The Flash.
Mm-hmm.
Good screen.
Big screen.
Saw a fan of the show.
Yes.
When we were there.
Hello Finn. If you're listening.
Thanks for saying hi to us. George, Napoleon, directed by Ridley Scott, tells the story of Napoleon Bonaparte.
Exactly.
Taking place from the 1780s into the 1820s or 30s, sort of like a 50-year period. And it's directed by Ridley Scott. It stars Joaquin Phoenix and Vanessa Kirby, and basically tells the story of Napoleon from his early days. The sort of documents some of the battles that he captained in his life, showing him at the peak of his powers and ultimately where Napoleon ends up at the end of the film.
Well, so I just would say it is really, just the context of Napoleon as a film is that you had a 1927 film made about it, Silent Era, and then Stanley Kubrick famously abandoned a project to make it. He'd researched it, and there are sketches that Stanley Kubrick did, meticulous detail sketches about militaria and like costumes about how to pull this off, but he could never really do it. It's this like lost Kubrick project. And now Ridley Scott, you know, industry heavyweight, has brought it to the screen. And you're right, picks up post-revolution France to, you know, a period of history, by the way, I'm very, very thin on.
Yeah.
My knowledge of Napoleon as a figure is very limited. I did say this to you when we came out. I said my knowledge of the Battle of Waterloo is basically entirely dependent on ABBA.
And I said Blackadder.
Yeah, Blackadder as well. So, Napoleon. So
also, that opens with the execution of Marie Antoinette in the most French Revolution style. Very grey, very like the makeup.
But immediately I was like, that's filmed at Somerset House. Just immediately I was like, and a lot of this is filmed in Malta as well. I could just tell away. Okay. You'd tell from the balconies. Ooh. Anyway, so Napoleon, directed by Ridley Scott. So here's the thing. Napoleon, it's an interesting one. I kind of have, my thoughts about the film are kind of exactly how I had going into it. Mm. What works is that this is absolutely Ridley Scott in full gladiator mode.
Yeah.
Big, bombastic historical epic. The film is kind of elevated and held into place by these tentpole battle sequences that are incredibly well executed, cinematic, undeniably epic, really feels like old school filmmaking. Totally. You're seeing cannon fire and cavalry. And we were talking about it afterwards.
Yeah.
The wrangling. I've never seen of all these horses. I haven't
seen horses.
A full cavalry, non-CGI cavalry charge in such a long time.
You totally feel
probably
that
it's like Lord of the Rings.
Well.
It's like the last time I saw a good...
Really breathtaking battle scenes.
Really well executed. And like, it's really well executed. The thing is with the film, though, is that, and at 2 hours 40, in between those tentpole action sequences, you have a lot of, frankly, crib sheet history.
Yeah.
Okay. If you go into this expecting a history lesson, you will be disappointed.
No.
You have the film feels very much like Ridley Scott playing the hits of Napoleon's life, flicking through his biography. It's like, oh, Josephine, Austerlitz, Waterloo, Russia.
Yeah.
And if you have, I was thinking about this when I talked about Oppenheimer, just to compare it to another long, weighty historical biopic we've had this year, which felt like Christopher Nolan really like reading through every single bit of detail of the minutiae of Oppenheimer's life, like in this dense biography. This very much feels like Ridley Scott flipping through the pages of a Napoleon biography going, yep, battle, yep, Josephine, yep, this bit, yep. And the thing is about Ridley Scott is that he's incredibly forthright, and which is great, and he's incredibly direct. This film was shot in 61 days, which is incredibly quick for a film of this size.
That's insane. Yeah.
Vanessa Kirby has said it should have taken 120, but they just raced through at 61.
Wow.
He moves at an incredible pace. But I think actually sometimes that comes through in the film. I've noticed this in a couple of Ridley Scott projects recently. He has this impatience with his own subject to almost deliver the film. It's 2 hours 40 and scenes are very brief, I'd say, on the whole.
Very quick.
They're really, really, like I said, he's flipping through it.
Apart from the tentpole battle scenes. Which are long, exactly.
And the kind of feeling I get is despite Ridley Scott being a heavyweight and being in his 80s now, there's something slightly juvenile in its execution in that it feels like a student writing an essay about Napoleon, spending lots of time on the exciting battles and then going, oh yeah, and also France was in chaos and also he had a wife called Josephine and then he went to Austerlitz and he had a really big battle and then he went back
and then he nearly died. It was so cold, but he made it back.
Yeah. And because of that as well, the film has a really strange tone. Visually, it presents itself as big, weighty, historical epic. But in terms of its script, it has this quite bizarre, often like flirting with thick of it, Veep style humor. At times I thought this is like an Adam McKay movie. You know, Adam McKay, is it? The kind of dialogue that's coming off, I thought this is really at odds with what I'm being shown and what I'm being told. It just kind of, it's really jarring. There's a line where Napoleon says to like the British ambassador, he says something like, you think you're so clever because you have boats. And I went to laugh, and then I thought, no, hang on a minute.
This
isn't meant to be funny.
The number of times I was like, what am I watching here?
What am I watching here?
And I don't think I ever really figured it out. I think within the first hour, because we're in a big screening, and people are laughing at the moment, so I can't tell, is that meant to be funny?
Yes.
Or is it just not landing? And I don't think I figured it out if Ridley Scott was going for humour there.
I think it's like Ridley Scott got excited by the idea of sending up historical figures and like making them look a little bit cartoonish, which I am okay with. I'm actually, that's really enjoyable. Give me that. But at the same time, like I said, visually, aesthetically, it's presenting itself as a very dour, very like aggressive military biopic. I think Joaquin Phoenix is just entertaining himself for this performance.
Yeah.
I think he looked at the script and said, not a lot here for me to go on. I'm just going to take what I can. Napoleon as an individual, as a man, remained a mystery really to me.
I agree.
I never came away thinking, oh, what an interesting, I never got inside of that character.
And that a very shallow attempt at the end with the blurb on the screen to like give you a sense of who he was, I thought, I guess.
Yeah. He plays Napoleon with all the things you'd expect. He's tyrannical, he's cold, he's petulant, he's childish. He's
cringe-inducing sometimes.
He's all the things that I kind of, even for someone like me who knows nothing about Napoleon, the stuff I knew, like, brilliant military strategist. Yeah, it was a bit of a tyrant. That was a bit short. I got all
they
that.
They really covered that.
No, they just made him sort of look a bit here and there. So you got Joaquin sort of doing his own thing. If you're going into this thinking, oh, I want a great Joaquin performance post-Joker, like what he's got next, it's fine. But Vanessa Kirby as well, like doing what she can with Josephine, absolutely fine. But I think that the whole film, I think, has this kind of strange swagger to it. It's a slight cockiness. And like I said, when Ridley Scott's this very forthright individual, you hear him in interviews, he will call a spade and he will like speak his mind. And the whole film has this kind of quite masculine swagger, boyishness.
Like Napoleon walking up the steps to go and claim the throne.
Literally like that. But unlike Napoleon the man, who had more under, clearly had more to him, Napoleon the film doesn't really have more than that. Mm. And I, to be frank, during sitting through some of the scenes, the in-betweeny bits, which there are a lot of because this film is 2 hours 40, I did get a bit bored. A little bit bored, frankly. Same. I kind of thought, yep. And the Josephine thing felt nothing. Yep, cool. And also, things would happen. Really big historical detail. As you say, this covers like a 30, 40 year period. I'm thinking, wow, this sounds like a really interesting time in France. I'm looking forward to Wikipediaing all of this when I get home, in absence of what I'm being presented here.
Yeah.
And sorry, I will get to what you think about it, but just it reminded me watching it that I kind of think, despite how energetic and exciting some of the sequences are, this kind of whole project feels a bit out of date in trying to capture an entire person's life in one film. You know, and a huge historical figure, let's do it from beginning to end.
Get Ridley Scott to do it.
And it feels a little bit outdated because I think, well, actually, I would be happy to watch 4 hours of this, 5 hours, 6 hours of this on a miniseries, where it really gets into the detail. But as it is, it's a surface level York notes, Cliff notes overview of his life.
It's almost quite, I was almost quite taken aback by the fact that big films rarely get that many high budget battle scenes.
Yeah.
This had three.
I think really at least, big. Hang on, Austerlitz, Waterloo,
Toulon.
And then interspersed with sort of minor ones, bit of Russia.
Do you know what I mean? Usually a film can't really do, especially in 60 days, can't really do like multiple of those. And it has three and you're like, and I think what I said to you coming out of it was, you know, the shots from the battle scenes, genuinely breathtaking to see.
Yeah.
Really well done, fantastically executed. I also quite enjoyed the spectacle of the political situation in France unraveling and also being improvised as it went along. Like, that person's talking, hang on, let's execute them. Oh, he's running away, he shot himself in the head. This person's, we're no longer in the monarchy. This person's now an emperor. There was something there in seeing that frantic energy coming there. And the battle scenes are amazing. And then just, in between it, the number of scenes I'm watching in between those moments and I'm going, that just didn't work and I can't quite figure out why yet, but on to the next one, next quick scene. That scene also didn't quite land for me. Mm. Here we are, the next one. Battle scene. And unfortunately, by the time you get to Waterloo, I pretty much know exactly, I've got everything I think the film is going to give me.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, with the Battle of Waterloo, I don't think there are enough stakes in the battle for me to really be on the edge of my seat. Mm-hmm. To have a big thing like that where you've been sitting with someone for 2 hours and a bit, I'm like, I'm not wondering like who's going to win.
Because we all know.
I don't wonder like what's going to happen.
I don't think it's a spoiler to know what happens at Waterloo, given the fact there's a train station named after it in the UK.
And so there's a spectacle of seeing it, which is engaging, but I'm now two hours 15 in and I've not got anything left. I don't think the film has got much left to tell me.
There is a couple of... really nerdily, there is a couple of military maneuvers in the Battle of Waterloo that I went, very clever.
Of course,
that's clever.
The dads who like do the sets with the battles, they are literally going to cream in their pants for those scenes. But
I think What I found slightly frustrating is that you have clearly historical significant figures played by, you know, Tahar Rahim's in this, which I love. Rupert Everett, although he actually gets quite a lot of screen time, but like characters such as Tahar Rahim's character, but also Napoleon's brother, who is sort of brought in and brought out, and is never really given
a dynamic.
I'm still confused as to what his kind of role and relationship was. It also has talked about tone, and talked about this kind of juvenile aspect. Yeah. It bizarrely sometimes would then have like extreme gore, like just suddenly, and in a kind of way which I find kind of a bit like cynical. I'm like, I was already invested in the battle. You didn't have to blow a horse up to.
Yeah, it's
to,
very like Gladiator Troy of the noughties sort of
swords and sandals.
Saving Private Ryan, that is, we put this gore in there for the real battle scene as it would have happened kind of thing.
I don't think it's as silly as something as House of Gucci. I don't think it's not as, it hasn't got a good enough script as something like The Last Duel. So the reason that Elevator, so I think in a way Ridley Scott is kind of as good as the script he's working from. And The Last Duel, which had a really great structure with the Rashomon style structure at the heart, that was really compelling. You know, good battle scenes in that, very kind of gripping.
Quite brave to tackle that subject in a medieval setting.
Absolutely.
And repeat scenes in that way, which I was genuinely interested to see the different perspective of those scenes in that film. Yeah, underrated.
Really, really underrated. And this is just kind of, it's entertaining enough for a bit, but it could be. When I was explaining it to someone, they said, don't give me any spoilers. And I said, well, really, like,
it's not
nothing that a quick read on Wikipedia wouldn't spoil for you.
No.
And in fact, you'll probably get more.
I enjoyed seeing that the battle in the middle, the Austerlitz one on the ice. Yeah. There was something that was really cool to see Napoleon at the peak of his military powers. Yeah. That worked for me as a battle scene, and it was brilliant done. But yeah, towards the end, I've got nothing left to do with it. And I think the film ends on a note that kind of feels like what you do as an audience member when you finish. If you've seen the film, you know, like the very last shot, like just kind of, just sort of ends with quite a pathetic whimper. And I'm a bit like, that's how I feel getting up from my seat in a way.
I'm going to say this in a vaguely unspoilery way, but the film ends with a kind of Godfather Part 3 ending. And I go, you're going to do the Godfather Part 3 ending? Yeah. I was like,
And splat.
Yeah,
it's kind of how it ends on a splat.
Yeah.
And you just go, all right, that last half an hour, I was basically done 40 minutes ago, but I'm glad you got to finish off your story.
And they come in and then they give you a postscript, which is like, this is why it was important.
Yeah.
This is why Napoleon was important.
Yeah, look at all the things. And again, I will say I loved looking at all the amazing houses in France. I loved seeing the interiors of the ships, the galleys, all beautiful, all really, looked like they were really there. Maybe they weren't.
But it says a lot that I was... you know, very quickly being like, oh yeah, I wonder where that's filmed. Oh yeah, that's filmed in London. Oh, that's filmed in Malta. I wasn't really invested. So it's fine. It could have, with the scant level of detail that it actually gives, it really could afford to be shorter. However, I wouldn't say it dragged because no scenes are very long, but I did get a bit boring. It did get a little bit dull.
Do you think, because it's an Apple TV Plus film that's getting a cinema release, do you think it lends itself more to being on in the background with a large glass of red and your dad going, well, did you know that actually...
I don't know, because Ridley Scott has come out and said that there is he wants to do a four-hour cut for Apple TV Plus.
No.
Wait, for Apple TV Plus, when he goes on the streaming, right? And now he said that he's not allowed to talk about that, because I imagine the head of Apple TV has said, you fucking what? But I think there is something to say that if it's 4 hours on Apple TV, well, maybe, but if it's more... just bittiness about 30 years of French history, then I'm also, I mean, I'm aware of this now after that, but when I was watching it, I was like, the French are going to hate this. It's just real
broad
brush overview of history.
Yeah,
the English thing is actually really interesting because, okay, thankfully we're past the era now of films where it's being set in France and people walk around talking like this. Everyone speaks in their actual...
Yeah, so Joaquin speaking in American accent, Vanessa Kirby in British.
But... when you have a massive legion of French soldiers charging a legion of British soldiers,
I agree,
and the skirmish is just full of people going, oh yeah, get off me. And look, James, I don't know my military uniforms from another one. I'm literally thinking, are those British soldiers who've just been killed?
No, I didn't know. Who's winning
French
there?
Soldiers?
Yeah.
And then, but then you'll get like the ambassador, the King of Austria, who turns up doing, you know, Austrian accent and the vague sort of Russian accent.
Like, there were two lines in German.
Because I think it's also, again, that like Ridley Scott is not really, he doesn't really care about the detail. He wants to deliver cinematic.
Epic, yeah,
he
epic
just
cinema.
Goes, do whatever accent you want. We're going to shoot it. We're going to shoot it like this. It's going to look really great.
I really do see myself YouTubing the battle scenes in like 4 years.
Oh, yeah.
And being like, God, yeah, that's really good. 10 minutes. What, yeah. How well crafted. Look at all those horses.
You could kind of do the battle cut, which is the probably an cut. Hour and 20 yeah. of the whole film.
The battle cut for the dads.
Yeah.
Yeah. Love it. You know, like you just want to like put something in front of your dad to keep him entertained. You just do that. Yeah. And they'd love it. Yeah.
But yeah, It's despite being made by an industry heavyweight and looking like a heavyweight film, it is actually surprisingly lightweight.
And as a series of features, it ticks a lot of boxes for a like, very appealing film. Ridley Scott directed, starring Joaquin Phoenix, historical epic, Vanessa Kirby, great, but just not.
Buyer beware, this is quite lightweight.
Yeah.
This is not.
Well, guys, as always, we'd love to hear what you guys think of Napoleon as well. If you have thoughts and you agree or disagree with us, send them in to hello@popkitchenpodcast.com and we will read them out on the show. Ooh, I always do.
When the Musketeers became like a unit, when they
yes, and they hold their things out. Great. Brilliant, really
that
love that.
That's really smart strategy.
Yeah, yeah.
That's beautiful why we
shot.
Won.
And then like the execution of the shots to telegraph that from above, below, perspective, horse running towards. I'm like, yes, I totally understand where you are. I do worry about the horses. Yeah. I know they're not really being hurt.
But do you know what? Also, like the first bit where like he's charging, and then his horse gets blown up by a cannon, and I was like, "Oh, we're doing that." And also with Marie Antoinette's head, I was like, "Okay, I guess it's that kind of film." I mean, not very subtle.
And Napoleon, like looking at Marie Antoinette's head, slightly glaring, giving this implied level of deep thought, but that doesn't really come back.
If you want subtlety, Napoleon, il n'est pas possible.
Napoleon.
Right.
There's that little scene that they cut short, I feel, when he does that almost like a coup and he marches up the stairs and he's got all these people. He goes, should we vote?
Yeah.
I thought that's a really powerful moment that I never really feel like got enough steam in there. Right, George, should we look at some of the emails that we get sent from the listeners?
Absolutely. Let's see what the sirens have been saying this week.
As always, guys, if you want to send an email to the show, as we said many times this episode, you can do by emailing hello@popkitchenpodcast.com.
Just like Michal has, with saying, hi, James and George. Michal from Krakow, Poland here. Huge congrats for the recent 100th episode.
Hi, Michal.
Hi, Michal. First of all, just before you continue, Michal, very great to have a listener from Poland. James and I both have Polish heritage.
Yes.
My granddad's name was actually Michal, and I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly. Otherwise, it's really embarrassing. But dzień dobry, great to have a Polish listener. I have finally caught up with all the episodes after going through your back catalogue over the last few months, and I must say that I really love your film discussions and that they often keep me sane while I do my silly corporate job.
Nice.
Those corporate jobs are silly, aren't they? Thank you, Michal. Before I ask you a question, I wanted to share a cheesy realisation I made. Some time ago, I realised that most of the films you review have one thing in common for me. They are all films that I've seen in the cinema with my boyfriend. The first film I saw in the cinema with him was No Time to Die, which coincidentally was the first film you reviewed on the show. It was.
Wow.
I was taking it. That was our second episode. We went to the cinema. It rained. It was a sad day.
Jimmy Carr was there.
That's right. We saw Jimmy Carr in the cafe. Yeah, really weird. We have bonded strongly over our love for cinema, so revisiting all these movies added a nice emotional layer to listening to your podcast, which I am very grateful. I wanted to ask you a question regarding movies that are based on true events, especially ones that take on very recent events. Do you think that there should be a cool down period before real events could be portrayed on screen to give filmmakers and the audience time to process them well and get good perspective? As a first Polish caller, correct me if I'm wrong, I will give two examples of Polish films, one great, one terrible. I will read these examples, then I think we'll go into answering the question.
Sure, yeah.
The first one would be the most recent film from acclaimed director Agnieszka Holland.
Well done.
I think that's Agnieszka, yeah. Green Border, which came out this year. In the film, Holland covers events of the humanitarian crisis happening since 2021 on the Polish-Belarusian border, where as a result of Lukashenko's propaganda, hundreds of refugees from Middle Eastern countries were trying to enter Polish territory and seek asylum with the European Union. The film does a great job of showing different perspectives of the problem through stories of its central characters, a family of refugees, a group of activists, and a member of the border guard. Even containing scenes of graphic violence and suffering, it manages to depict these events with respect to the victims and of a crisis and is a huge and important lesson in sympathy. I strongly recommend you give it a try, as it is both informative as very well crafted and contains the best acting talent with I think that's Maja Ostrzyska, arguably the best Polish actress in one of the leading roles. The worst execution of the topic, however, would be Smolensk, directed by Antoni Krausz, That talks
doing really well with all those Z's and CH's in there.
That talks about the tragedy of a plane where the Polish yes, I remember this actually. Yeah, where the Polish president and 90 other people on board crashed in the Russian town of Smolensk. The film follows a fictional reporter leading an investigation regarding the disaster, who with each encountered evidence regarding disaster, encountering evidence which becomes sure that the crash was not an accident but in fact an assassination. Okay. Mm. The problem of the film is that it does not even try to show various perspectives and cynically indulges in conspiracy theories and propaganda. Poor plot choices and terrible acting turn the film that was supposed to honour the victims of the tragedy into a meme. Mm. So what do you think? Can you think of a movie that depicts recent events successfully or fails to do so? We'd be very happy to hear your opinions on the pod. Sorry for the long email and probably a few grammatical mistakes. No, actually, I think you've written that very well. Yeah. Thank you so much for all the content you're creating. Keep up the good work. And then signs off with... Hold on. I want to get this right.
Oh my God.
I think it's Sadezhny Pozdraviam. Sadezhny Pozdraviam. Michal.
Sent from one of
the pigeons from Krakow's main square. Have you been to Krakow?
No.
I've been to Krakow three times. I love it. It's a really great place. Really friendly people. Just love that. On that question, then, James. By the way, thank you for flagging two films from Poland. You know, we'd love to hear from films outside of our normal remit. Totally. So that's great. About films that have been released too soon.
I think ultimately you can't put an embargo on art and say you're not allowed to tell the story for this amount of time. But there is something to be said about the rapid rate at which some things are immediately put into film, the Hugh Grant Boris Johnson, the Kenneth Branagh Boris Johnson thing from recently is one where I was like, this is too far away. But then similarly, not that this is the same amount of time, but we watched 13 Lives earlier, and I thought that was a really well done telling of that story that felt really respectful. Again, it's quite a few years before, but I don't know how you would.
I think when it comes down to, in a way, it's how people. The first thing is it's how people feel about the event itself.
Every event is different.
Exactly. And how people, and also the execution. So with 13 Lives, yes, everyone knew the story, but the way it was, the detail with which, and the focus.
I had no idea how long that tunnel was,
so
it's, and
justified
how
its existence.
Yeah.
But you're right. But with the Boris Johnson COVID series, which came and went, didn't it? I think you're the only person I knew who saw it and talked about it.
And also that Benedict Cumberbatch Brexit, Dominic Cummings thing.
Oh, no, but actually, I'll get
close
to that, because I
thought it was good, but still, it's very close.
But the thing with the COVID thing is just that COVID was such a huge thing, and by the sounds of it, that didn't really offer any other insight other than capitalising, in a way, on the kind of...
The misery and the
prominence of COVID in our minds. Again, with the Brexit film with Benedict Cumberbatch, that did seem a little bit like sleazy and trying to, again, here's a massive thing that's a cultural debate in the country right now, let's make a thing about it. But actually what that film did do was uncover all about the, you know,
Cambridge Analytica,
Dominic Cummings. So that was interesting. It's also interesting recording this at the time, or answering this question at the time that The Crown season 6 has come on.
Yeah.
Because although the events in The Crown season 6 to do with Diana 25, 30 years ago, everyone's relationship and culturally the relationship with those events are very, very emotionally volatile. Mm. People have very strong opinions
about that.
That's
20 plus years ago.
Well, exactly. So it's a huge amount. It's enough time to make something about it.
That's also the...
The rawness and it's the sensitivity around that is still very, very strong.
And the execution of The Crown in particular is very dramatic, very elevated, very sincere. Mm. And so when something is more matter-of-fact, it's not as held to this great regard, whereas seasons 1 or 2 of The Crown, very dramatic, but because...
Yeah, 70 young, years ago, yeah.
It doesn't matter that we're seeing these arguments, and I don't really criticise the things that are said, because what would I know? And it works for that. But the closer you bring it to time, I'm like, well, Charles.
These, a lot of these people are still alive.
Yes, totally.
And with the... I was just thinking also, like, with 9-11, with, like, U 1993, that film came out 10 years after. Less than probably about seven... I think United 93 came out in... You seen it?
Yeah.
Came out in 2009?
2006.
Okay. Wow, really?
Yeah, 2006.
So that's an interesting one. So United 93 came out 5 years...
Are you thinking about World Trade Center with Nicolas Cage?
No, but they're both the 9-11 films that came out. I remember it now. Both 9-11 films that came out 5 years after the fact. I haven't seen World Trade Center, but I remember... But the thing about United 93 that works is that it is focused on one specific story from that day. And does it in a very detailed,
World Trade Center simile is the same in that sense.
Just not trying to capture the whole thing. And it's like, I haven't seen World Trade Center, but United 93 is a really powerful, yeah, powerful. But you know, it's a powerful watch. Very good question, Michal. I really appreciate that email.
This next one is from Jamie, who writes into the show with, hello, James and George. Jamie here, a 24-year-old student from the Lake District in Cumbria, but hello. Studying in Manchester. I am a, in all caps, huge fan of the show and have been an avid follower for over a year now and finally managed to binge all of the back catalogue of episodes this summer as I returned home from uni.
Absolutely.
The episodes helped me to keep my sanity as I worked night shifts at my local Sainsbury's.
Bit like how Michal said, keeping the sanity.
The sanity.
Are we? What would happen if we
weren't
there?
You guys are on the edge.
People are right on the edge. Yeah. I need some pop kitchen to calm me down.
Guys, everyone, be chill out there. Everything's okay. My girlfriend Amelia and I both share a love for film and TV, and so I introduced her to the pod and got her hooked on the show too. And now we eagerly look forward to Wednesdays for a new upload, of which we always watch in bed with snacks and an essential cup of tea. Oh, hello.
That's amazing. Bed. Hey, enjoy your bed. Hope that cup of tea's nice.
Do we dip our biscuits in the tea? I hope so.
Of course. That's really cute.
I love that. Guys. Hello. Ooh, snuggly.
I feel like we should get all cozy now.
We should do a bed episode, like in bed with mics. That'd be weird.
No, but this folds out.
You could
do the whole...
The whole bed thing.
Like
an informal show. A new show.
Oh, you've just inspired us. Watch this space.
My question to you guys is, are there any personal favourite scenes of yours in films that already have well-known and established great scenes that aren't recognised widely as great scenes from those films? In other words, underrated scenes in films that have other well-known and well-regarded scenes.
Got it.
So a really good film with a really good scene that a lot of people don't necessarily comment on being a good scene. For example, for me, Saving Private Ryan, 1998, is well known for its opening Omaha Beach scene and Wade, the medic's death scene, to name just two. These scenes are well known. However, for me, my favourite scene from this film is the scene where the main group of soldiers are in dispute about abandoning the mission, and Tom Hanks' Captain Miller goes on to give his monologue that reveals his background home and his life as a teacher to the soldiers who had been wagering about his occupation back home. The scene then ends with the line, just know that every man I kill, the further away from home I feel. This scene always stood out to me every time I watched it. It's set apart from all the violence and noise of the rest of the film and really focuses in on the characters. It's almost as if the film stops and everything around them pauses as they have this interaction where nothing else matters but what Captain Miller has to say. The monologue reveals the humanity, vulnerability and reality of all men, even those deemed to be fearless leaders. It's an incredible, heartfelt and powerful scene and remains one of my personal favourite scenes and monologues in the film. Do you guys have anything similar? Also, controversial opinion, courtesy of my girlfriend Amelia, Kangaroo Jack, 2003 is a comedic masterpiece. She would love to hear you discuss.
Wow, I haven't heard that mentioned in ages.
I've not heard Kangaroo Jack. I know of the film. Finally, just want to say big congratulations on 100 episodes. Thanks for all the laughs. Great film and tea debates and discussions. Here's to many more episodes. All the best. Jamie and Amelia, brackets, sirens on our end. So, George, Kangaroo Jack.
Never seen it.
I've not seen it.
I remember seeing the adverts on TV. I remember seeing the video in Blockbuster. Never seen it.
I imagine there's a CG kangaroo in there which can't have aged well.
Yeah. Oh, no.
But do you know what, Amelia? If you say it's a comedic masterpiece, I'm happy to believe you.
But great scenes in movies that already have great scenes. So you said about Saving Private Ryan. I agree. I flagged this a few weeks ago, but the scene where the mum is dialogueless, but she's washing up. It's Ryan's mother and she sees the car coming and she knows that it's so powerful. I'm trying to think of when we did that episode last year about great scenes in movies. So for example, we did, I said that scene in No Country for Old Men. The gas station scene. So now I'm trying to think, okay, what are the other good scenes in that movie? I've always liked that at the end when Anton Chigurh, you know, Javier Bardem's character, sits down and catches up with Kelly MacDonald, and she sort of doesn't give him the kind of satisfaction that he's expecting. Because it compares with the Woody Harrelson scene earlier, where Woody Harrelson scene's like, you don't have to do this. And he's like, why does everyone say that? You don't have to do this. But with Kelly MacDonald, she kind of I can't remember the exact dialogue, but puts him in his place and says no, you need it. And even though we don't see what happens in the scene, although what's great is that the following moment we see him walk out of the house and we don't know what's happened, but he just checks his boots underneath, which just tells you all you need to know. But it's great. It's the one kind of moment of weakness you see from him in the whole film. It's the one time you see him kind of get caught out. Help me, James. Other great scenes.
One that comes to mind for me, it is a film with multiple iconic great scenes, is The Matrix 1, right? Filled with them. But one of my favorite scenes in The Matrix 1 is when Morpheus is captured and Agent Smith is trying to get hack inside his brain. And he has this moment where Hugo Weaving delivers any line of dialogue brilliantly, but he takes his earpiece out and he says, I'm going to be quite honest with you. This place, this zoo, this reality. And it's what's incredible is you realize that the agents, or specifically Agent Smith, are way more interesting as villains than just brute antivirus software. He is like real. He is sentient, and he realizes what he's living in, and he's desperate to get out. And that makes the character of Agent Smith and the dynamic between them and the agents so much more interesting. Because if you didn't have that scene, Smith isn't interesting, but because he's aware of the dynamic, that becomes so much more interesting to me. And I always thought the delivery of that line was just brilliant. And he unplugs himself so no one else can hear him. Yeah. It's like, what? He's a sentient thing. Brilliant.
I've talked about the Truman Show before, about how loved the scene with the bus in the center where Truman realizes that something's not right. But I also just love the scene at the end where, spoilers, he hits the wall with the boat. And he's just hitting it with his hand. He just does. He doesn't understand the edge of knowledge. Yeah. He's like, it's like this very primal reaction. He doesn't understand the reality stopping. That's
pretty
great.
The voice of Ed Harris, like speaking to him through the sound, as like a voice of God, an all-knowing mother.
Yeah,
it's really quite. It's really deeply unsettling when you think about, from Truman's perspective, what that would be like. That's all you've ever known.
I'm trying to think of what I used to, what any films that I've sat down and cherry picked out the scenes from.
Yeah. Jamie, we can't think. It's really hard to think of. I've got loads of really great film scenes that everyone knows about, but it's thinking of the second best one.
The second best one. Yeah, it's really hard. We've given you a couple.
Yeah, we also have an episode, which I'm sure you've listened to, of great some of our favourite scenes,
yes,
which we should really do another one of, because I'd love to prepare five each and come make a good episode about it.
For those who want to head off to that episode, if they haven't listened to it, which because maybe they're a new listener who haven't gone back, that episode was episode 25. It was episode 25 that was the... It was called Films That Have One Great Scene. Films That Have One Great Scene. This next email is from Oliver, who says, "Dear James and George, I've been listening to you since the early days. And while I used to listen to a lot of film podcasts, Pulp Kitchen is now my primary source of film nourishment."
I love that. We're like top of his food chain.
I like that.
There's carbs, protein, Pulp Kitchen at the top.
Don't start your day without it.
Without it.
Thank you so much for hosting such a wonderful pub quiz night.
Yes, Oliver, I remember you.
Yes, we remember you, Oliver, of course. My girlfriend's sister and I thoroughly enjoyed racking our brains as we carefully listened to production studio music. Mm-hmm. Superb idea, by the way. And while we could see the poster for Bo is Afraid in our mind, for the life of us, we couldn't bring the title into focus. Mm. The whole evening was much needed and relief during a particularly stressful week at work. And it was absolutely thrilling to meet you both in person. A very funny night surrounded by fellow film enthusiasts. Listening to episode 101, I was reassured to hear I wasn't the only one who freaked out when you came over to say hello and you knew my name. Given the large following you have on social media, I was genuinely shocked you recognised me, but absolutely delighted. Needless to say, I became a little tongue-tied in the moment, but you were both charming, incredibly lovely, and superb hosts. Even if I may have come across as a bubbling mess, Oliver, you were lovely.
I think not Oliver, at all. Multiple things. You had booked tickets, and I see the names on the list, which I'd printed out, so I'm like, oh, that person. And I've also seen you on Instagram giving us love. Yes. So that's why I knew. I was like, yes, you must be Oliver, and then your last name.
Because you were doing what everyone else was doing, what everyone should be doing, which is liking, subscribing, sharing, all that kind
of stuff.
Oliver,
we know you, we see you. Thanks for listening.
On the whole, the quiz rekindled my need to see a wider range of films, which brings me to my question. Which streaming platforms do you think supply the best array of films? I already have a few: Netflix, Disney Plus, Amazon, Apple, and Now, but I'm tempted to explore something like Mubi, which seems to cater for the more niche and independent films. Well done on surpassing 100 episodes. Here's to many more. Sirens on our end. Thank you, Oliver. James, which streaming platform do you think provides the best?
So you said the best array of films. Array. So are we talking about selection, quantity, back catalogue, originals?
I think the whole package.
The whole package right now.
In terms of movies.
In terms of movies. Well, this is the thing. Like, Apple has... You can buy a la carte all the movies, right? Yes, but I don't really count that as being provided as part of Apple TV Plus.
The only free ones to watch are the Apple TV originals.
I think of all of them, Apple TV Plus to me is leaning towards, it was attempting to be a more prestigious, high quality content band. They all look very premium. They all look like they're bringing in the best. There's a lot of money being spent on the best talent around, but I can't say that all of them capture the public sentiment like I think Netflix has the ability to do. When a Netflix show really hits, it's all everyone's talking about. Mm. But for every one of those, I think there are 15 shows
come and go
that you've just never heard of, and go, and like something your mum's mate watches.
Yeah.
and you'll just never hear from them. So Netflix's approach is clearly make as many things for as many people and hope something sticks, but in the meantime, you create a lot of shovelware. I can't say that Amazon impresses me that much with their suite.
So I actually haven't, because of all the apps we've got, you've mentioned here, all the stream platforms, the UX of Amazon is the worst. We've totally. Always known that. And I have to say that has severely impeded how much
not
I go on
to it.
Not good
for discovering films.
No,
at all.
Not at all. So I actually haven't gone on Amazon to look for films for a very long time.
Yeah.
While I'm talking about that, I will say that BBC iPlayer has increased the amount of films they have on selection. Yeah. And I recommend that if you're having a night in and you're trying to go through each platform, in the UK, of course, trying to find a
You'll
film
be surprised,
to watch,
pleasantly
don't
surprised.
Forget to look at BBC iPlayer because they've got a lot of stuff there.
For me, Amazon, I'll go, oh, I'd quite like to watch this film. I wonder if it's included with Prime.
Yes.
And I will check Amazon first to see if I can watch it in a good quality for free.
Exactly.
And then I usually don't bother.
I actually have to say that I think just by product of it being the largest entertainment conglomerate on the planet, that Disney Plus is a fairly solid bet.
For a library,
because on the one hand, you have new stuff if you want to see the big you know, blockbusters. Yeah. But they have Star, which is their package apart of Disney Plus, which offers a huge amount of back catalogue. Not even all Disney films either. Obviously, they have the entire Disney back catalogue, which is a lot. But they have a good selection of films on there that are just from the ages that are, you know, handy to watch. And they have also, because Disney now owns Hulu, you get nice, interesting Hulu projects coming on there as well. So
totally.
And Fox Searchlight, they now own that, which is just now called Searchlight, I think, because Disney bought Fox. So.
Right. Okay.
So together, as a package, Disney Plus actually is fairly good. But what I would say, if you're unsure, try and balance. Because I've also got Mubi as well. And yes, Mubi is a little bit harder to kind of crack open on a Friday night. But yeah, if you have some time in your diary, or you're in an appetite to see something a little bit stronger, a little bit better, of Anatomy of a Fall-like quality, Mubi's going to be it. So I'd say balance it. Have a Disney and a Mubi kind of thing.
Oliver's
or
also,
a BFI player, sorry, as well.
Yeah, sure. Oliver's also included Now, which is technically Sky, which is technically HBO.
Well, more than HBO, because Sky Atlantic is just HBO.
But that's included with Now TV.
Yeah, so Now includes that, but also movies as well. So yeah, there's...
So Now, like, quite a good old package to have. I, like, have Sky Go on... My dad's Sky Go account on my PlayStation, which gets me access to Sky Sports, and, like, the odd HBO show, which I'm really appreciative of. And if I didn't have that, I think I would be like, oh, God, I really want to watch that.
I would say that we are getting up to the point there where people are really totting up which ones to cut.
Yeah,
because they're getting expensive, and
it's if all of these are now $16.99, we'll get to that point. It's a lot of money to spend on content.
Hell yeah,
but yeah,
Oliver.
Also, I do think Netflix has a good suite of films. If you go onto the film section, whether you go like trending now or they do like the critically acclaimed and new, there's usually something there that you can go like, okay, there's loads of great films there.
The benefit of something like Mubi as well is that it's just film. It's not TV.
Yeah.
It's and it's research and it's specific, and you will see stuff. You mentioned here, Oliver, about trying to spread your wings and taste a little, you know, wider range of things.
And also, Disney has an interesting UX where it's like, it has the five main banners of like Star Wars, Marvel, Disney, Pixar thing. And you're like, oh, what do I, where am I putting myself right now? And it does have those different tabs.
I think
like,
also
tabs.
People forget because they, what star? No one knows what star is. But if you click on star, it's got other stuff in there. Anyway, Oliver, thank you for your email. Lovely to hear from you. Those were our answers.
This last one is from Helene, who writes in and says, hello, I just got round to listening to your episode about The Bear Season 2. I pretty much agree with everything you said, but I had a question. Guys, George reviewed The Bear Season 2 fairly recently.
As a bonus episode.
Do you think there is enough comedy in The Bear to justify it running as a comedy at the Emmys? I personally feel a little weird that a show where I almost chuckled once or twice an episode could run away with best comedy in front of something like Ted Lasso or Abbott Elementary. That's almost pure comedy.
Yeah, I this has been a conversation for a long time. It happens. It always happens at the Emmys and the Golden Globes where it's like,
that's a comedy.
Like, that's a comedy. Is that a? But The Bear does fall into that trap, and I mentioned this where it's like, structurally, and in its DNA, it's a comedy. I'm not saying it's trying to be a comedy. I would have always described it as a drama. Absolutely.
Yeah.
But with its predominantly half an hour episodes, its whole premise, you know, family-based kind of side characters, whole structure seems very comedy DNA. Yeah. But I do agree, I would have described it as a drama. I'm sure there is some very boring technical argument, reason, box to tick when you submit the Emmy form, which is like standard drama, are this long, and standard comedies are this long.
And so you want to go and you want to buy as many tickets to that award raffle. Sign me up for all the categories.
So I don't know. Yeah. So if it's in as a comedy, it probably has more of a chance of winning because it seems more prestigious. But
we had 48 seconds without dialogue. Could we be best silent film? Yeah. Guys, thank you so much. Those were all the emails we got sent today. We are now going to move on to the games. But if you wanted to send us an email, you can do, as always, by emailing into, say it with me, guys, hello at porkkitchenpodcast.com.
Welcome to the game section of this episode, where I will be giving you some games this week.
Love it. Are you ready? Yes.
For £3,000, are you ready?
No. I wish.
James, I'm going to give you two, name 7 in 30.
Okay.
And then I'm also going to give you a caster's countdown.
Okay.
Are you ready, James? Everyone, if you're familiar with this game, you should know that I'm going to ask James to name 7 somethings and he has 30 seconds to do it. Let me get my stopwatch ready. Okay, I'm going to go in with the hard one, I think.
Okay.
James, in 30 seconds, name for me 7 A24 movies. Go.
Oh, Beau is Afraid, Midsommar, Predatory. Saltburn? Is it not?
Not sure.
I think it is. Okay. 824. Let's go. Lady Bird?
Yep.
Let's go. God, it's really hard to think about exactly what's A24.
10 recent. Seconds.
What's it? Recent A24 would be.
Big World.
Oh, I think it was Arrested.
5 seconds.
Is it the Witch? Is
yes.
A24. And I'm going to go for all of them. Lighthouse.
Yes. Yeah. Just in time. The Lighthouse. You could have also said,
God,
of course,
that's hard.
Everything Everywhere All at Once.
Yeah. Which true.
Won the Oscar for that. I believe also The Whale. Many, many stuff.
Oh, yes.
Yes. The Witch, The Lighthouse, The Northman.
Yeah. Yeah. Robert Eggers, Ari Aster. Quirkies.
Exactly. You did it.
Yeah.
You played it safe with your three Ariasters.
Yeah.
But fair enough.
That was the most recent one I'd seen that was an A24, but we got there.
Woo! Okay.
All right.
Your second question, James.
Mm-hmm.
In 30 seconds,
okay.
James, in 30 seconds, name 7 movie musicals. Go.
Grease, Mary Poppins, Sound of Music, Cabaret. Movie musicals. We have also got Les Mis.
Mm-hmm.
We've also got Cats.
Yes.
And we have got movie musicals. I'm going to go Bedknobs and Broomsticks.
That and Mary Poppins, I don't count as musicals because they are musical films. They're not based on existing stage musicals. So you have 7 seconds to give me 2 more answers. Have forgotten Chicago.
Chicago.
And
Chicago.
Of course, I mean, In the Heights. That's a musical film. I think that's a musical film. It's not the same as a musical. You know what I'm saying? That's to be a musical.
Dreamgirls.
Sweet Charity.
Dreamgirls. Yeah.
No, I think Dreamgirls was a film first.
Was it?
I think so. Hairspray.
Jersey Boys.
Hairspray.
Hairspray.
Jersey Boys, well done. Yeah. Jersey Boys was a film. No one remembers the film of Jersey Boys.
No, but it came out.
But you see my point. It's like Bedknobs and Broomsticks. Yeah.
West Side Story.
That's a musical first. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Nice. We got there.
Whew.
Lovely. Great.
Okay. And your last game, James, is a traditional old cast list countdown.
Get it in.
As everyone knows, I'm going to read out the cast list for a movie. James has to guess what movie this is before I get to the end. James, are you ready?
Yes, let's do it.
Lots of people in this who've been in lots of things.
Great, can't wait.
Let's play cast list countdown. James, can you name the movie from this? James, can you name the movie from this cast?
Mm-hmm.
3, 2, 1, Rose Byrne. Catherine Hahn.
Bridesmaids?
Dax Shepard. Ben Schwartz. Timothy Oliphant. Connie Britton.
Oh, God.
Corey Stoll. Adam Driver. Jane Fonda. Tina Fey. And lastly, Jason Bateman. Do you have any idea?
Jason Bateman, it's not like Game Night or something.
No,
Jason
not bad show.
Bateman, Tina Fey. No, I don't think I have it. Go on.
That is the 2014 movie, This Is Where I Leave You.
Oh, yeah. Did
which
we?
I've seen and is okay.
Yeah, it's a sort of forgotten comedy from the 2010s.
It's not great. It's not amazing. But
Good cast.
Yeah, great cast.
You know, a lot of names in there.
Kill for that cast.
Were you about to ask if we've done that one before?
I think so. Did we bring it up?
Whatever. Hey, I'm all for sustainability, and that was recycling. We have. But if you did, it didn't help you, did it?
No, not at all. Not at all.
That was Caster's Countdown.
Actually, no, never mind. That was Caster's Countdown.
That was Caster's Countdown. Thank you very much for joining us for this episode 103 of Pulp Kitchen. Next week, we should hopefully have reviews of Saltburn and May December, if not more.
Don't
forget again to look out for the bonus this week, which is about Dream Scenario, the new Nick Cage film, and a good Nick Cage film, not one of those crappy ones he puts out, like an actual good one.
Yeah.
And Anatomy of a Fall.
Guys, thank you so much for listening to this episode of Pulp Kitchen. We really appreciate you spending your time with us every single week. Don't forget, we post new episodes of this show every single Wednesday.
And whether you're working a silly corporate job or listening to us with tea in bed,
all are welcome.
And please make sure that you like, subscribe, share, follow, click, heart, comment, laugh. We really appreciate all of that stuff on the social media channels.
If you're listening in bed, you've got your laptop, phone, TV, likes, subscribe.
Yeah.
Just, yeah, come on.
Go on that TikTok and be like, heart, laugh, laugh, laugh. Instagram, love this. Add to my story. Love these guys. They're amazing. It really helps us grow and it keeps us going. We love hearing from you. We really appreciate it. Have a great week, guys.
Bye, guys.
Bye.
See you next week.